Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief on Columbus Day weekend. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, what does John McCain consider to be a priority for a president of the United States?
Personally, I prefer someone who I know was a solid grounding in my faith.
We'll find out why McCain needs a refresher course on the Constitution he's promising to uphold. Plus, is the Episcopal Church on a collision course with itself? Why do the developments at the National Meeting of Episcopal Bishops point toward a split in the church? And later, Senator Ted Kennedy joins us to celebrate the Senate victory on hate crimes legislation and to warn us that the fight isn't over. But first, making some sense of John McCain's nonsensical statements about religion. You've probably seen the headlines this past week. No Muslim president, said one. Constitution established a Christian nation, said another. Well, all of these headlines were describing Senator John McCain's answers during an interview with BeliefNet.com. And I think it is terribly important for us to take a listen to the full comment, not just the headline sound bites.
I admire Islam. I think that there's a lot of good principles in it. I think one of the great tragedies of the 21st century is that these forces of evil have perverted what's basically an honorable religion. But no, I just have to say in all candor that that since this nation was founded primarily on Christian principles, that that's a decision that the American people would make. But personally, I prefer someone who I know was a solid grounding in my faith. But that doesn't mean that I'm sure that someone who is Muslim would not make a good president. I just feel that my faith is probably a better spiritual guidance, of better spiritual guidance, but I don't say that we would rule out under any circumstances someone of a different faith. I just feel that that's an important part of our qualifications to lead.
My goodness. Now, you need to know the Interfaith Alliance has already released a statement about the Republican presidential candidate's remarks. I personally call them outrageous. But I wonder if you get the feeling while listening to that clip that McCain dug himself into a hole that he didn't quite know how to get out of. The stumbling and equivocating make it seem like he knew things weren't going well. Well, at least he was right about that. Let's find out what the man conducting the interview thought of these answers. With us right now is Dan Gilgoth. He's the political editor of BeliefNet.com and author of The Jesus Machine. It's our pleasure to welcome him back to the show. Dan Gilgoth, thanks for joining us again on State of Belief.
Reverend Gaddy, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
Now, I'm curious, did you get the impression that McCain really understood what he was saying when he made those comments?
You know, I think that's a really fair question, and I think that's what I and a lot of other folks are wondering about. Because on the one hand, you know, with his kind of anemic campaign, you could understand him wanting to make a pretty clear play for Christian rights support. On the other hand, if you look at some of his responses and kind of how labored some of them were and how he seemed to be kind of stumbling along and wondering if he was saying the right thing or going too far, one of the things that came to my mind is this is a candidate that doesn't spend a lot of time with the Christian right and probably hasn't had to therefore answer a lot of these questions. And so I'm wondering if some of it just revealed how uncomfortable or how kind of unschooled in some of his responses he might have been.
We counted 8 separate times, I believe, in which McCain referred to the U.S. either as a Christian nation or as a nation founded on Judeo-Christian principles. And I think this gets at what you were just talking about. But I'm interested in your impression as to whether he was indeed pandering with these comments or if he really believes the nation should be governed by a Christian.
I think he does. I think he said that pretty unequivocally, that his preference is for someone who shares a deep grounding in his own faith. He himself is, if not identifying as a Baptist Christian, is very clear that he has attended a Baptist church and is in discussions with his pastor at the moment about undergoing a full immersion baptism and becoming really a full-blown Baptist. I think it's telling that even after he issued a clarification saying that he would vote for a Muslim if they were best qualified to, I think in his parlance was, protect American values. I think it's telling that he didn't clarify that his preference is indeed for a president who shares his own Christian faith. And the overtones of talking about wanting to undergo this full immersion baptism is that it was a kind of conservative evangelical brand of Christian faith.
I know that McCain, after the interview, contacted BeliefNet with a clarification of the comments that he made. What do you make of that? Was it a clarification? Did it have the spirit of an apology about it? What was that about?
Well, I think he just wanted to give himself some room. And in a way, I think it presented an opportunity for McCain to have it both ways. That is, he was on record as preferring a candidate for president who shared a deep grounding in his own faith. On the other hand, the clarification made it clear that he wouldn't rule out under any circumstances in supporting a Muslim. So he was able to come across with his clarification as a little bit more conciliatory and less sectarian in his views, and yet his comments about preferring a candidate who shared his own faith background, you know, were still allowed to stand.
Do you think the comments he made will hurt him, or more cynically, do you think they will help him with Christian conservatives? After all, we've already seen the Family Research Council praise McCain's remarks.
Earlier this week, the Christian Coalition, an official blogger with that organization, also issued a statement to the effect of these kinds of statements might help McCain rescue what is otherwise an ailing campaign. And so I think it's an interesting question whether McCain is either regretful for having gone too far. On the one hand, a lot of groups ranging from Christian to Jewish to Muslim have issued these demands for McCain to retract his comments, particularly about the U.S. being a Christian nation or supporting a president, preferring a president with his own faith background. On the other hand, you have all these groups on the Christian right. They considered McCain to be public enemy number one, all of a sudden, you know, warming up to him. And so I think just as far as politics go, these comments might wind up benefiting him in places that he's struggling, places like Iowa, a lot of cultural conservatives, places like South Carolina, where, after all, McCain lost to President Bush in 2000. And so it might help him notch up support in states like that.
As the political editor of BeliefNet, do you see the use of faith on the campaign trail becoming more intense or dying down as the weeks progress?
What was interesting is that it is becoming more intense, but that it's kind of late in coming on the Republican side of the ticket. I mean, you had McCain making his remarks to me late last week. You also had Rudy Giuliani sitting down with the Christian Broadcasting Network and talking about his own faith in Jesus, the fact that he prays to Jesus, invoking episodes from the New Testament, kind of in support of his own plight. And what you're seeing is there's just a huge block of conservative, particularly evangelical activists, but other Christian conservative activists on the Republican side who were undecided. The Iowa caucuses are less than 4 months away, and the clock is really ticking here. So in the next month or two, you're going to see Republicans make a serious play for this huge block of undecided activists, and I think that's going to really bring out the God talk.
We have a link to the BeliefNet interview with Senator McCain at stateofbelief.com. Dan Gilgoff is the political editor of BeliefNet.com and author of The Jesus Machine. Dan, it's always good to have you. Thanks for coming back on State of Belief.
I really enjoyed it, Reverend Gaddy, and I hope to be back.
I've got some comments of my own for Senator McCain in my Preaching to the Choir segment up next. And we still have Senator Ted Kennedy later on in the show. So stay with us. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. You know those comments we heard from Senator McCain, the ones regarding his desire for a Christian president? They're reminders that even our highest elected officials are sometimes ignorant of what it says in the U.S. Constitution. It's one of the reasons the Interfaith Alliance is part of the First Freedom First campaign to reinforce our right to religious liberty as outlined in the First Amendment. The First Freedom First campaign is still going strong, and it was recently the focal point of an evening of comedy in New York City. The group Laughing Liberally hosted a night of stand-up in Lower Manhattan to help reinforce our First Amendment rights, specifically the protection of our first freedom, the freedom of religion.
For me, the freedom of religion issue is more like freedom of non-religion.
Yeah, they always like, but it's in the Bible that you can't be gay. Yeah, you know what else is in the Bible? That you can't wear a linen wool blend.
Comics will tell us that they love Laughing Liberally because when they perform at stand-up comic clubs, the owners of the club or the managers will tell them not, you know, to stay away from political issues.
Various evangelicals blame 9/11, the tsunamis, and Hurricane Katrina all on gay people. And I don't know what you've gotten out of this. All I gathered is gay people are more powerful than you ever imagined.
Honestly, like, comedy's not going to change anything, but it's just an easier discourse, like, in which to get these issues into the mainstream.
If comics do nothing more than, like, provide a social network for people who are doing the pavement pounding work, that's totally fine and noble, and I would feel fine knowing that that's the most that we would accomplish.
In addition to this event, a little more than a week ago, I was the moderator of a First Freedom First panel discussion in Manchester, New Hampshire. On the eve of the Democratic presidential candidate's New Hampshire debate, we brought our message to the Granite State, reinforcing our belief that our first freedom is jeopardized when religion is brought onto the campaign trail. We'll be continuing First Freedom First events like these all throughout the election season. Go to firstfreedomfirst.org to check out the event calendar and find out when we'll be in your neck of the woods.
Amen.
You probably have figured out that I have a lot on my mind regarding Senator John McCain's BeliefNet interview. I'd like to share those thoughts with you in my Preaching to the Choir segment. Maybe some of these things are on your mind too.
Amen.
Doesn't anybody get it? How could the admired patriot and respected senator from Arizona, John McCain, not know that the United States Constitution does not establish the United States as a Christian nation? Has Senator McCain been reading the literature of the revisionist historian David Barton, who has been traveling the nation on the payroll of the Republican Party, pushing the fallacy that church-state separation is not in the First Amendment to the Constitution? Or was this a campaign tactic in which the statement will linger and an apology for it will fade, playing to a badly needed base of Christian conservatives? Or maybe it was just a senior moment, or an inexplicable snafu. Now, don't forget that Senator McCain made his comment about a Christian nation while expressing his opinion that it would not be good for the United States to elect a president who is a Muslim. Is a Muslim running for president this year? No. But the statement was yet another way of making a point that, in contradiction to Article 6 of the Constitution, Senator McCain approves of the electorate using a religious test for people running for the Oval Office. Well, unfortunately, McCain is not alone in making appalling statements about religion in our government. And the malady is not unique to Republicans. The front runner among the Democratic presidential candidates, Senator Hillary Clinton, continues to support President Bush's so-called faith-based initiative. Recently, Senator Clinton called for faith to be injected into public policy. Whose faith, Senator? Yours? Or Pat Robertson's? Or James Dobson's? Or the faith of one of our listeners to state a belief? Who decides what religion should guide public policy? Doesn't anybody get it? I'm not against faith, you know that. I've spent my life engaging religion, but no election is or should be about religion. It's about qualifications for public leadership in an ideologically diverse, religiously pluralistic nation that promises rights and freedom to everybody. Mr. McCain, the President of the United States, is not a kind of civic archbishop elected to preside over a Christian nation. The president is a national CEO charged with defending the Constitution, promoting the public's welfare, and practicing good international citizenship. Mrs. Clinton, we don't need a faith-based initiative in the White House. We need to get rid of the one that's there. What kind of victory would it be for a presidential candidate to win a nomination or even the election and in so doing, further weaken the Constitution? Now look, if the candidates just have to talk about religion during this campaign season, let me suggest that they focus on religion's commendation of fidelity to a Constitution written by visionary pragmatists who appreciated the goodness of religion, but feared like death the consequences of religion, one religion or any religion, getting a stranglehold on government and taking over the nation. Still to come, Senator Ted Kennedy on getting one step closer to meaningful hate crimes legislation. And up next, can the fracturing of the Episcopal Church be prevented? I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
The Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
Welcome back to State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We've been following with great interest the conflict within the U.S. Episcopal Church. The disagreement about gay clergy and the blessing of same-sex marriages has reached critical mass in recent months, with a handful of congregations leaving the U.S. Church to join the Anglican Church of Nigeria. Last winter, leaders of the Worldwide Anglican Communion, of which the Episcopal Church is part, issued a decree giving the U.S. Episcopal Church until September 30th to clarify its official position on gay rights. If the church were to strike a position of which the leaders didn't approve, the U.S. Church could suffer expulsion from the Anglican Communion. Well, that deadline came during the Episcopal Church's annual House of Bishops meeting in New Orleans last week. And in a nutshell, here's the conundrum the U.S. Church had to face. Does it remain loyal as a member of the global Anglican Communion, or does it remain true to its interpretation of inclusiveness? Here with us in the studio to talk about the decisions made in the past week by the U.S. Episcopal Church is someone who's been following the story intently. The Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon is the former bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C., and now is senior advisor for interreligious affairs at the Interfaith Alliance. Jane, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton. I'm delighted to be here.
Jane, what was clarified in the document that bishops eventually wound up drafting at the meeting in New Orleans?
Welton, just this afternoon came over the internet the report of the Joint Standing Committee to the Archbishop of Canterbury. The two primary concerns were, was the Episcopal Church going to give official rights for the blessing of gay and lesbian unions, marriages, some call it, and would the bishops of the Episcopal Church, those with jurisdiction, that means those bishops who are in charge of their diocese, would they consent if a diocese in the church elected a gay or a lesbian bishop? Actually, the language they use, whose manner of life causes concern to others. Well, the document that came across this afternoon, the report of that Joint Standing Committee, and this is, I read their words, "We believe that the Episcopal Church has clarified all outstanding questions and have given the necessary assurances sought of them. That means this committee believes that the bishops gave them the assurance that there would be no official rites and public celebrations of gay unions, and that the majority of bishops with jurisdiction would not consent if a diocese elected a gay or a lesbian bishop in a committed relationship."
My goodness. Now, Bishop Dixon, I don't want to sound judgmental. I really don't. But is the Episcopal Church compromising its own beliefs?
This bishop believes that we are. I will tell you what happened. Archbishop Rowan Williams came at the invitation of our presiding bishop, the Right Reverend Catherine Jefferts Shorey, and the House of Bishops, who met in March 2007. They invited him to come, and in his first address to us, I was in New Orleans, Welton, for this meeting, and what he said, I've taken pretty clear notes about this, that the sense of the crisis is not just about sexuality, he says, but about ecclesiology. He defined that, what the church really is. And he said that the Episcopal Church in the United States of America has taken steps before waiting for common discernment throughout the 38 provinces. And he says he believes that we are caught between balancing fidelity to gay and lesbian persons and to the common discernment. I think that we decided to go with that process of common discernment, and that we have done this on the backs of our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters.
I don't mean to be too cynical, but you and I know churches, Episcopal and otherwise. I've tended to find calls for more discernment most prevalent among people who didn't think the discernment so far pleased them.
I agree.
Well, are the conservative bishops happy?
No, they're not happy. In fact, 51 bishops throughout the world met in Pittsburgh on the 28th of September. They are seeking to find a different relationship within the Anglican Communion, those who cannot accept the ordination of gay and lesbian persons. There are some within that group who cannot accept the ordination of women. Now, what they will do, we still don't know, because the Constitution of the Episcopal Church in the United States does not allow a diocese to remove itself. However, the Diocese of Fort Worth, the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and the Diocese of San Joaquin in California, and also the Diocese of Quincy, are seriously considering a resolution in their diocesan conventions to remove themselves from the Episcopal Church.
So the conservative bishops that met in Pittsburgh don't want any more discernment.
They don't want any more discernment. They feel that the discernment has been made.
And I want to go back and reiterate something you said, because it passed by quickly. They view the ordination of women with the same disdain that they view the ordination of gays and lesbians.
Not all of them. Some of those bishops ordain women. Bishop Duncan, I believe, ordains women. I'm pretty sure about that. Bishop Eicher, Bishop Ackerman, and Bishop John David Schofield in San Joaquin do not ordain women.
Bishop Dixon, the church is split. Is it going to be recognized as split?
I don't think so. I think that this communique that just came forward this afternoon is going to say that the American church did what it needed to do to stay in communion. I don't know how that's going to play itself out and whether the primates, there were, not all of the primates of the Anglican Communion were there, only a few. So whether they're going to accept that or not, we won't know until the Archbishop of Canterbury is in touch with them.
Isn't it possible that in the history of Christianity particularly, sometimes a split has had more integrity about it than staying together?
Well, certainly as an Anglican, we would say that when we did that 500 years ago. We felt that we were part of that great Reformation, and the Archbishop of Canterbury referred to that, that sometimes there is need for reform. I happen to be one of those who believe that that's one of these times in the church.
Friends, we're going to continue to follow this story on the fate of the U.S. Episcopal Church, and we're always happy to receive analysis and opinion from Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon. Jane, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, comments from Jesse Jackson on the volatile case in Gina, Louisiana, and Senator Ted Kennedy joins us to tell us why a case like the one of the Gina Six would be a whole lot different with the passage of a federal hate crimes act. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. By now, most of you have seen the recent images on television of the protest marches in Gina, Louisiana, prompted by the case of six black teenagers being charged with attempted murder. Last week, I had a chance to speak with Reverend Jesse Jackson, who took part in those protests calling for the Gina Six to be freed. Those protesting see an injustice in the way these teenagers are being prosecuted for beating up white students, while the white students didn't receive any kind of prosecution for hanging nooses from a tree, an action that prompted the fight in the first place. Jackson spoke about the details of the case and the need for federal assistance. Reverend Jackson, what is it about the case with the Gina Six that has touched such a raw nerve?
Well, because of the collapse of our criminal justice system in the country, period. There's a Gina in almost every state. More young blacks are in jail than college in every state. Jail for profit is now driving how long you stay in jail and what the charges are. There's something that's undemocratic and unwholesome about that. I mean, three nooses were hung, which are hate crimes, but they were not charged. They were dismissed as pranks. Well, hanging nooses and swastikas and burning crosses are not pranks. These are hate crimes. Those who did it should have faced prosecution as a deterrent. You had the case of the young black who was beaten, and they would not allow him to complain, which is his civil right. That's a violation. The young man that they stopped next day had a shotgun. They took it from him and unloaded the shotgun. They were charged with stealing his weapon. That's absurd. The fight in school, black and white kids fighting with fortunately no guns and no knives, and only the black kids were charged. The manifest injustice there makes people question the application of law.
Do you want the federal government to step in?
We absolutely need federal intervention. As we need the federal intervention in Montgomery in 55, we need it in Selma in 65, we need federal intervention in Louisiana. This is a system that must now be totally exposed.
Well, in addition to the light this case shines on our criminal justice system, it also points to the poisonous damage done by hate crimes. That's why the Interfaith Alliance has long pushed for comprehensive hate crime legislation on a federal level. And after last week, that legislation, I'm happy to tell you, is one step closer to reality. The Matthew Shepard Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2007 received passage in the United States Senate with a vote of 60-39. This legislation will provide federal assistance to state and local law enforcement in order to investigate and prosecute bias-motivated crimes. Joining us right now to talk about this victory and where the bill goes from here is the senior U.S. Senator from Massachusetts and one of the co-sponsors of the bill, Senator Edward Kennedy. Senator Kennedy, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you so much for welcoming me to your program today. I really appreciate it.
And Senator, I want to thank you for mentioning the Interfaith Alliance and the work that we did from the floor of the Senate when you introduced your remarks on the hate crimes legislation.
Well, I want to tell you how much we valued, all of us in the United States valued the Interfaith Alliance, not just a statement, but a support for this hate crimes legislation. So I appreciate the contributions of you, Reverend Gaddy, and so many of the Alliance on causes that are so important to the country. The Senate listened to your message, and your support was so essential.
Senator, why does this legislation appear as an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill?
We have been trying to get this legislation for 10 years. We got it accepted in the United States Senate as an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill last year, but it was dropped in the conference, and we got it accepted in a previous Congress. The reason the Defense Authorization Bill is because Defense Authorization Bill is to give our fighting men and women the training, the leadership, and the equipment to fight terrorism abroad. And we thought if we were going to fight terrorism abroad, we also ought to fight terrorism here at home and give the same kind of support for those that are going to be fighting terrorism here at home. Our fighting men and women abroad are fighting for the values of our country, and obviously they are fighting for our freedom and our liberty, but our basic and fundamental values and hatred and bigotry and prejudice are so alien to those values for which these men and women are fighting for. This is also a reason it should be included.
How likely is a presidential veto on this bill?
The president has never vetoed a defense authorization legislation in the history of the country. He's said that he's thinking about it, and that's why it's so important that people let the president know that he should put away his veto pen. There's some $670 million authorized here for the national security and the security of our allies and friends overseas. There's a very important pay raise for our fighting men and women. There's a very important help and assistance in this legislation for the wounded. And for many of those who have suffered as a result of our military involvement. So this is a very important piece of legislation, and it deserves to be signed into a law.
If it's not, do we have the votes to override the veto?
Well, I believe we will by the time. I hope certainly that we will. We've had 60 votes at this time, and we had some of our members that were missing, the presidential candidates, were here. They came back for it, but we were missing some, and I think we need to make sure that we'll get as many votes as we can. But I would hope that the president would see the wisdom of signing this legislation. This is really about terrorism here at home. And, you know, we passed, Reverend, as you remember, hate crimes legislation after the death of Dr. King. Mm-hmm. And the country came together and said, we're not going to stand by while we have hate crimes, as it was directed to Dr. King. But we find out now that that legislation did not really cover all the kinds of hate crimes that we're seeing taking place today, and that had a lot of gaps in it. And that's why this legislation is so important. This is a continuation of our commitment as a nation. It goes back to Dr. Reverend King and others that have experienced the kind of bigotry and prejudice and hatred that too often has been there in the past.
Senator Kennedy, I'd like for you just to help our listeners with wording when they get asked the question, why do we need a federal hate crimes law? Isn't that for states to deal with? What's the best answer to that question?
The best answer to that question is that all crimes of violence are bad and have to be dealt with. But some crimes are focused on individuals about who they are because of the color of their skin or because of their sexual orientation. When we have a crime against one of them, it's not just a crime against the individual. It's a crime against a whole group. And we shouldn't fight those battles with one arm tied behind our back. If we're talking about those who've been singled out because of their disability, there have been people singled out because of their religion. There's been people singled out because of their race. And there have been people singled out because of sexual orientation. And that is a hate crime, and we ought to deal with it in a serious way.
Senator Kennedy, you honor us by being with us. Thank you for being with
us
on State of Belief.
All the best.
Bye-bye. Well, that's our show for this week. If you want to respond to anything you heard on the show, go to the Contact Us page at stateofbelief.com and send us an email. Or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. We'd love to hear from you. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Members of the Interfaith Alliance make this show possible. So if you like what you've heard today, think about becoming a member yourself. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Now, before we go, I want to say a huge thank you to each and every one of you listening right now. We just received some very positive news about the ratings of State of Belief. Despite the fact that this show has been through three time changes within the past year, our audience continues to grow. Not only does that mean we're being joined by new listeners every week, it means our longtime loyal listeners have stuck with us week in and week out, no matter where we ended up on the schedule. We can't thank you enough for your support, but we can promise you that we're going to keep bringing you the quality programming that you've given resounding approval of through your listenership. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.